Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Welcome to 2019. Bring it on. Well, if the first week of the year is any indication for this year, it's going to be it's going to be interesting. As the Chinese say, which by the way is not a compliment from them, it's kind of a curse. May we live in interesting times. The first week was unbelievable, and I'm going to go over it a little bit with you. The gist of the show, at least the last half of it, is going to be on a very, very concerning trend in gun control at the local, the state, and the federal levels. And you haven't heard about a lot of these laws that are getting passed, referendums that are getting voted in, and what's going on at the national level, including with Rhino Republicans working in lockstep and concert with the Democrats, the progressives. I've talked before about why the Second Amendment is important. I've talked about why the globalists around the planet, UN, you name it, small arms treaty at the UN, why they are so desperate to disarm America, since America is really the last armed country in the world. But I'm going to save that discussion for another time. What I'm most concerned about is that you are aware of the tidal wave of anti-gun, anti-gun owner legislation and referendums that are sweeping the country, almost without exception. And you will be alarmed. I mean, you will be alarmed. And I guarantee you that you haven't heard about a whole bunch of this stuff, and I'm only scratching the surface. I'd need 5 shows to tell you about all the laws that are being passed hither, yither, and yon by unthinking. Well, I take that back. They're thinking. The removal of firearms from the American psyche, American homes, and American hands is all part of a much larger plan. These people aren't stupid. They're smart. You need to know what's going on, and at the end of this show, you will. We're also going to talk a little bit about the economy. I've been talking about that. You know, I started beating the alarm bells for you 9 months ago. For those of you who haven't heard it, one of the most popular shows of last year, and that was The Canaries in the Economic Coal Mine. Type it in the search bar, it'll come right up. I did several follow-up shows, too. You can kind of see by the archives that you might want to listen to, and I did a show, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago. Just type it in the search bar, 6 reasons the value of your home is going to decline. Listen to those shows if you have not. You know, cycles are cycles, and cycles can be worsened, deepened, heightened, sped up, and slowed down by certain acts and lack of acts, primarily of the government, and in our case, the Federal Reserve. But there are certain things which weaken economic structure. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about that this morning. But most of all, I want to, it's going to tie in with my story, too. Yes, I have a story for you. As several emails reminded me from last week, I didn't have a story on my year-end show, because there's just too much to cover on the year-end show. But I'm going to make up for it. I'm going to make up for it this morning. And it'll tie right into this economic, shall we say, mini-theme of this show. We're going to talk a little bit about the first 24 hours of the Democratic House of Representatives. You know, they took power on Thursday morning. They work frantically like little busy bees on lots of nothing, as you'll see, all day, and then they voted themselves a 4-day vacation. So the Democratic House of Representatives, folks, has been in session for exactly, about 10 or 12 hours, and wait till you hear the list of all the things that that they, in quotes, did, unquote, you will shake their head. You'll shake your head. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Judicial Watch, a bright light in this huge and rampant voter fraud stench, cancer that's permeating the country, that was on full exhibit in the midterms, that resulted in the loss of at least 26 Republican seats. I mean, strictly voter fraud and criminal electioneering by Democrats, and almost resulted in the loss of the senatorial seat, Rick Scott in Florida, and Ron DeSantis as governor of Florida. I'll remind you, by the way, that Florida, incredibly, voted that felons have their voting rights now restored. That's 1.4 million people in Florida. Remember that the elections of DeSantis and the elections of Rick Scott were decided by 33,000 votes and 12,000 votes, respectively. Now, that's after lots of voter fraud and several hundred thousand suddenly mysteriously found votes after the law allowed. Nonetheless, that's a really, really big number of new voters, even if just a quarter of them vote. I think you'll find it interesting, though. Judicial Watch is just a great group. And I really want to kind of pump them a little bit this morning. Send some money to Judicial Watch. They are doing just a yeoman's job on a myriad of fronts. I don't know how they get to all the places they get. One day they're in the Supreme Court arguing one case. The next day they're in the California Supreme Court arguing another case, which they just won. Another day they're in federal court in D.C., arguing over FOIAs to make the government cough up documents that the Congress can't get on the Hillary Clinton, Comey, you know, dossier stuff. I mean, they're phenomenal, and they need your support. They run strictly on donations. So judicialwatch.com. Let me just check that website for you real quick. Yes, judicialwatch.com. www.judicialwatch.org. Excuse me, .org. Judicialwatch.org. Go on their website. You can see the stuff they're doing. Subscribe to their newsletter. It's free. And it'll keep you up to date monthly on all the great stuff they are doing around the country. And send them some dough. $10, $20, $50. These people are, well, right now, they're the point of the spear of the defense of the Constitution. So, the other thing we're going to talk about this morning, we're going to talk about we're going to talk about Mr. Romney, Mitt Romney, and his unbelievable speech, or actually interview on CNN, and his op-ed in the Washington Post, you know, Jeff Bezos's paper, the day before he's sworn in as United States Senator. This guy has so lost my... I mean, I've talked about this prior. I talked about it during the election when he was on his bully pulpit spouting his nonsense about Trump. And here he is coming in as a Republican senator from the conservative, still red state of Utah. And just, I mean, it's just unbelievable. In the middle of the border wall dispute, the government shut down, and he's grandstanding. You know, except for the fact that he lost to Obama, and I think everybody, all of my listeners know exactly what I think of Barry. I almost have to tell you, I'm glad he lost. I think he would have been death by a thousand paper cuts. The guy is just scary. He's just scary. And we're going to talk a little bit about, in the context of that, what he thinks of Trump voters, what the Never Trumpers think of Trump voters. We already know what the progressives and the Democrats think of Trump voters. But there was another guy, Richard, whatever his name is, I mean, some GOP strategist who's a never-Trumper, who was on CNN. Wait till you hear what he called us. You know, all the names we've been called, we now have a new moniker, folks. We have a new slur attached to us. And the more I listen to these people rant and rave and dribble down their chins with anti-Trump supporter dribble, the more I realize that what I've been telling you for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years before Trump was elected. If you remember, I was one of the few media people that told you from day one, from the day he came down that elevator, that escalator at Trump Tower in New York and announced that he would be the next president of the United States. I think only Sean Hannity and I were the only ones who said emphatically, I mean, others kind of hedged their bets and said, yeah, I think he could, da, da, da. Sean and I were the only ones who said he will win. This guy is the next president of the United States. And the hatred that is directed toward Trump is not hatred toward Trump. Oh, yeah, you know, there's plenty of progressives and, for that matter, non-progressives that can't stand his manners, so to speak, or his tweets or his rough around the edges or, you know, all that stuff about him, which all of us kind of like, although sometimes even I cringe a little bit at what he does or says. They hate his policies, folks. And they really, really, really hate, despise, hold in contempt and disdain, and look down their snotty, elitist, leftist, quote-unquote, well-educated noses at you and I. We are really who they dislike. Trump is just the visible symbol. You know, we're the amorphous mass of 65 or 70 million people, probably more than that, but that's how many voted for him. We're the amorphous mass. It's they can attack us obliquely, as I'm going to give you some examples of tonight, and as you've heard in the past, Hillary with her basket of deplorables and Barry Baby with his bitter clingers comment and all this. So we've been attacked as a mass. But our election of Trump took these people by surprise. They really thought they had won. They thought the fundamental transformation of America with immigration, with laws, with regulations, with the creation of the deep state and the shadow government by Barry, which was has been on full display at the FBI, the DOJ, the State Department, you name it, since Trump's election. They really thought this was it. Hillary was going to get in. She'd appoint the next couple Supreme Court justices. The Supreme Court would be, you know, liberal forever. And all these regulations, they could build regulations on regulations. They could cram down carbon taxing and climate change laws and policies. You know, increase taxes, you name it. They thought they had it in the bag. And you know, if Hillary had won, they would have. But Hillary didn't win. Trump won. And you know, even in the dim recesses of their elitist brains, they understand that Trump didn't win because he pulled a voting lever. He won because we pulled the voting lever. And they hate us for it. They never liked us. They've never respected us. They don't even consider us a viable block of voters that they even had to appeal to, because rather than appeal to us, they're simply replacing us with voter fraud and illegal aliens and dead people voting and, you know, demographic shifts to turn red states blue, which, for instance, they did very successfully in Colorado, which they're trying to do in Texas, which they've kind of half done in Arizona and Nevada, and which they've done, once again, halfway, actually more than halfway in Virginia. They can't stand us. They can't stand us. And every time you hear somebody throw an epithet or a slur or an insult or a nasty, demeaning comment at Trump, understand that that comment, that slur, that barb is really directed at you and I. It's really about the Bubbas. They don't like the Bubbas. They don't trust the Bubbas. They don't believe the Bubbas have a single brain cell between all of us. And certainly, because we are racist and misogynist and, you know, in their minds, anti-diversity and, you know, cling to that quaint conception of originalist constitution, strong defense, America first. I mean, we're just archaic dinosaurs. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that this morning and tell you what our new name is, according to this Richard, whoever he is, GOP, never-Trumper strategist. And then we're going to get into this really scary stuff about the Second Amendment. And by the way, what I just told you about how they feel about us and how we, in their minds, don't matter because we're replaceable, not convincible, but replaceable, i.e. the battle over the border wall. The attack on the Second Amendment, folks, is their way of disarming the Bubbas. They want the Bubbas disarmed. Because, you know, that you can't really have your way with the Bubbas if they have all the guns and ammo. And some of you are probably shaking your heads going, oh man, you know, conspiracy. I'm telling you, it is part of a much bigger plan. This is not, this is by no means accidental. This is by no means just kind of the drift of things. This is prodded and directed and intentional. All right, let's get started. So let's start off with our story, shall we? It's really two stories. It's two stories. Story number one. I got into a discussion with, I was coming back from visiting my mom for New Year's, who's doing great, by the way, in her book, The Turquoise Lady, is doing great. For those of you who hadn't checked it out, please do, turquoiselady.com or Amazon. Coming back from seeing my mom at New Year's, and I stopped at a gas station to fill the one ton up with diesel. Pretty long drive back from Point South. And I'm at the counter. And there is a... I'm checking out, I think it was a coffee or whatever I was getting. And it was fairly late at night, although there were a number of people on the road. You know, it's the end of the holidays. And there is this tall, kind of thin guy with a graying ponytail, kind of pulled back, long ponytail. And, you know, my initial impression was, you know, this guy's probably a liberal. And there was a lady behind the cash register. And she was small in stature, kind of thin, kind of frail looking, certainly older, I would say, probably early 70s. And it was a rural area. So my initial perception was that she was a conservative. And in the course of checking out, one of the things I bought just for snacks, I bought a couple avocados. And I realize that's kind of a weird traveling combination, avocados and coffee, but you know, what can I say? The cowboy's a little weird. And the tall gentleman that was waiting to check out after me said, oh, that's a bunch of avocados. And I laughed, and just because it was late at night and I was kind of punch drunk from driving, and also because it's kind of my nature, I said, well, I'm buying them in case Trump doesn't get the wall built. And he laughed. He goes, that's a good one. And the lady behind the cash register looked at me through squinted eyes with a definite frown on her face. And I realized that I had them completely the opposite. The tall guy with the long, graying ponytail, who looked like a hippie, was a conservative. And the little old lady who lived in the rural area was a liberal. I thought about it for about an hour after I left that service station. And it reminded me that you can't judge a book by its cover. Which, by the way, we'll be getting into as we talk about this gun control, because Some of our Republican friends up there, both in Congress and particularly in the Senate, don't judge them by their cover, the cover being so-called Republicans, because they're ready to sell your gun rights down the river. The second story is a true story. One of the many newsletters and information sources that I have had this fascinating story on previous economic downturns. And I'm not going to go into those particular details, but in the course of the story, the writer, his name is Mike Barrett, he told a story, kind of a heartbreaking tale of stock fortunes won, you know, money made in the stock market, big money, and then suddenly lost. So let me tell you this story, as it's kind of recanted here by Mike Barrett. And it is, according to him, a true story. He was my friend. Like many people in their 60s, Bill had moved to Florida after living most of his life somewhere else. In this case, in Corning, New York. Crystal City, as it was known then, is also the world headquarters for the glassmaker Corning, which for those of you folks who have stocks is GLW on the exchange. It's a Fortune 500 company back then. Dozens of manufacturing facilities all around the world, and Corning's roots in what had been a fairly small town back then started in 1851. I mean, like the very beginnings of America's glassmaking industry. Bill loved Crystal City, Corning, New York. He was friends with all the people at the Corning plant and the Corning offices, and they took their kids to sporting events together, and they, you know, hobnobbed at church socials and at the country club and wherever else. I mean, it was a company town. And Corning took care of its employees, stock options and all sorts of stuff that was kind of pretty heady things back there in the 90s. Bill had taken all his shares of Corning that he kept getting as stock options and all the dividends that those stocks paid and bought more stock, Corning stock, with that. I mean, his portfolio was pretty much solely Corning stock. And the stock did okay. And then in the 1990s, the stock went crazy. I mean, it went nuts. In fact, the value of shares for Corning shareholders doubled between June of 1999 and then December of 1999. And then they doubled again, peaking in about August 2000. They got up to the lofty level of $325 a share. I mean, that's a fairly expensive stock, particularly back, you know, 2000. That's 19 years ago. And Bill, and lots of people like Bill, lots of Corning, you know, middle executives, upper executives, managers, they had a whole bunch of Corning stock. I mean, if you had 2,500 shares of Corning stock at $325 a share, you had close to $1 million. It was a lot of money. And a lot of them had more than that. And nobody, including Bill, sold their Corning stock. Because after all, you know, they loved the company and they loved the company town and the company had been good to them and the stock had gone crazy. And now it's August of 2000. And for those of you who follow economic cycles and economic history, you know that August of 2000 was literally right before the dot-com bust in 2000. So Corning's 1,200% increase, that's 1,200% increase in stock value in the 24 months before that, overnight, like in 60 days, it was worth nothing. I mean, literally, when the tech stocks, when the dot-com bubble burst back then, and the tech stocks crashed, $5 trillion in paper wealth of people all around the United States in all sorts of stocks, not just Corning stocks, disappeared. And when I say disappeared, I mean it was gone. And it wasn't like, it didn't take years. It was virtually overnight. In terms of markets, it was overnight. In terms of real time, it was like in a 30 to 60 day period. And all these people who had held on to this stock and who had been literally multimillionaires because of the rise in the stock, they watched this stock go down 50% in the first 60 days. And by October of 2002, and most of them still didn't sell, the stock was down to $3 a share. I want you to think about that. 1,200% rise to $325 a share, and then literally within an 18-month, within a two-month period, a 50% decline, and within an 18-month period, almost a 99% decline from $325 a share to $3 a share. Well, look, all these folks obviously got wiped out. And I'm sure that many of them are thinking back to, if I had only sold, right? Like maybe every time they turn on the light and still go to work at age 70, they think about it. My point is here, and I'll give you a little bit more history about Corning. I did some research on it. So there's a lot of reasons for Corning's decline. There, number one, you had the overall bust in the market with the dot-com bust. And Corning had been over-leveraged. It had bought all sorts of businesses, taken on all sorts of debt, was expanding everywhere, and everything caught up to it. You know, its acquisition belly, or its acquisition appetite, was far bigger than its financial belly, if you can kind of follow that analogy. And when it bottomed at $3, it was a hated asset. I mean, nobody on the face of the planet wanted to touch Corning stock. But you know, there are people out there who are contrarians. And those are people who say, okay, if everybody is jumping over the left cliff, I'm going to take the right highway. And people started to buy, mostly big investors. They started to buy Corning stock at $3, and within several years, the stock was up 10 times. You know, back up to $30 a share, which is not $325 a share, but if you got in at $3, that's a pretty good hit for your money in a pretty short period of time. The bottom line of what I'm telling you with this story, and I think you'll find it fascinating, economic history. The economic cycle is something that's way bigger than all of us. The underlying macro forces of the economy, whether it's the world's economy, whether it's a particular state or locality's economy, or whether it's the national economy, are much, much bigger than you and I and all of us put together. And they are not stoppable. It's not like you can say, okay, I can stop this thing that's going on in the stock market today. Or I can stop the coming recession. Or I can stop this, that, or the other. And some of these market forces are exacerbated, usually poorly, almost always poorly, let me correct that, by the government and by the Federal Reserve. And now, because everything is globalized and everything is interconnected, you know, the curse of technology in a way, by what's happening around the planet. You know, an investor, a bank can sneeze in Shanghai and you can have what's called a contagion, which is the ripple effect of that sneeze in New York. Didn't used to be that way, but it's certainly that way now. Never before, and I've gone over some of these facts with you before, but I'm going to recount them for you. I think it's really important. One of the biggest services I hope I do for my listeners, those here in the United States and around the world, is I acquaint you with a set of facts which are generally not presented to you in any other form or medium, and certainly not presented to you kind of all put together in a bundle of dots. Yeah, if you spend as much time as I do reading all this incredible amount of information and material that comes across my desk and computer every week, you'd know all the dots too, but you don't have time to do that. That's why I do it for you. And in that respect, I think I'm virtually the only media source out there, or one of the very, very few, that brings together a whole bunch of information from a whole bunch of different spheres and places and puts it in one soup bowl for you, and then stirs it and picks up the noodle out of the soup, which you can either eat or not eat, up to you. So we have some things going on that we've never had going on before. We have $20 trillion in primary national debt. We have $200 trillion, give or take $20 trillion, who cares, of unfunded liabilities. Pension funds, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. We have pension funds in distress around the country. Connecticut, particularly. Illinois, particularly. California, particularly. New Jersey, particularly. By the way, you mentioned, do I need to tell you they're all blue states? We have a number of states which, despite the vibrant national economy, are on their butts because of leftist programs within the state. Taxing, regulation, you name it. Several weeks ago, I did a show on the Northeast housing market. And I followed that up with a show, and you can put that in, Northeast housing market. I'm sure it'll come up on your search. You can listen to the show. The week after, I followed up with a microcosmic example of that market, New Canaan, Connecticut. So here you have a general economic boom. Like just yesterday, there were 312,000 plus or minus new jobs, and all the morons who are the experts were projecting 175,000. And Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, had a little speech where he said, well, you know, maybe I won't raise rates twice next year. And, you know, and if I have to, I'll stop this quantitative tightening where we're not buying $50 billion worth of treasuries every month, which is tightening up the money supply. And just on that maybe, that kind of ephemeral, well, I don't know, maybe. And on the jobs report and a couple of other economic indicators that were quite strong that came out, the market shot up 600 and some odd points, 660 I think it was. As you know, last week, any of you who are in the stock market, and I'm sure some of you are, some of you aren't, most of you, I hope, have some type of retirement plan, IRAs or KEOs or 401ks. They're in the stock market, folks. So you may not be in it, but your money is in it. Unfortunately, controlled in many cases by somebody you don't know, and in many cases by people who don't know what they're doing. And this volatility in the market, there's a number of things which foreshadow a downturn in an economy. Just like there's a number of things which foreshadow a business getting into trouble. I gave you the example of Corning here in the story. I mean, the Corning example is fascinating. This was a go-go Fortune 500 company. It was hitting home runs, grand slams, and it just got too greedy. It just bought too much stuff. It tried to do too much at once. And whether you're a big company or small company or just a household, you know what happens when you do that. It's kind of like what the government is now in America. It's trying to do too much stuff, and it doesn't do any of it well. None of it. The thing it does best probably is defense. And, you know, even that's woefully inadequate and mismanaged and money wasteful. And we have, you know, we have a bunch of morons up there in Congress, Democrats and Republicans included, who spend millions of dollars on how fast snails move and, you know, the dance of the dart winder salamander and, you know, the sexual appetite of the three-year-old monarch butterfly, whatever. You know, this is our money they're spending. This is why we're in debt. And it's all paybacks to this group or that group. I mean, it's as corrupt and insidious as you can get. It is the swamp. It is the deep state. It is crony capitalism. And it is at a level that we have never seen before. The corruption in our government is at a level we have never seen before. So that also makes this time unusual. We're coming out of a period where, well, in Europe, they still have negative interest rates. You literally pay the bank to have deposits there. And they pay you to have a mortgage. I know that sounds insane, but that is what's still going on over in Europe. The United States didn't get there, but we got as close to 0% rates as you can get, and that's because we had an anomaly that we have never had before, and that was the Federal Reserve adding $4 trillion to their balance sheet, all of which was manufactured money with which they bought our own bonds and treasury notes. We printed money to buy our own debt. I want you to think about that for a minute. And that's called quantitative easing. And what we have going right now, we've never had before, which is quantitative tightening. They're reversing those purchases, that printing of the money and the purchase of our own debt at the rate of $50 billion a month. That's $600 billion a year. And when they, for lack of better terms, let me paint a picture for you. When they take that $50 billion out every month and they burn those dollar bills so they can't be back in circulation, that is $50 billion that's no longer on the planet. And that is why money is tightening. There is less money, United States dollars, in the world. And there's $50 billion less United States dollars in the world every month. And what happens, folks? We're all capitalists, original constitutionalists. What happens with a commodity that there is less of that is in demand? Its value goes up, or its price goes up, however you want to look at it. And the price of money is interest. So not only is the Federal Reserve tightening, increasing interest rates, 12 times in the past 3 years, 6 times in the past, give or take, 12 to 14 months, they're also burning, throwing over in the dump and burning, so they're no longer out on the planet, $50 billion a month. Which I would argue is probably has more effect than the rise in interest rates. So that is something that we've never had going before. What's another thing that we haven't had going before? Think about this. Think about the move from online, from brick and mortar retail, you know, shopping at brick and mortar stores, to buying things online. From getting in your car and driving down to Macy's or JCPenney's or Kmart or Walmart or wherever you go, to sitting in your home, hitting a few keys on the computer, and buying it from Walmart or Amazon or one of, you know, the other hundreds of thousands of online retailers and having it delivered direct to your door. That's a major structural change in how this economy functions. Listen, there are other things that set this time period apart, and part of it is politics. You have a very corrupt government that is in the stranglehold of a deep state bureaucracy. You have a rising class of radical left. Wait till the next thing I'm going to talk about. A rising class of radical leftist legislatures who just took control of the United States House of Representatives 48 hours ago, and who are decidedly anti-America, anti-Constitution, anti-capitalist, pro-redistribution, in some cases pro-reparations, think about my shows on that, and who are decidedly not e pluribus unum, from many one, but rather the creators, as I talked about on last week's show, of a class of victims and the stitchers of those classes of victims together as their voting constituency. Now, we've had that to some extent in the past, but we have never had it to the blatant and overwhelming extent we have it now. And all of this type of stuff breeds uncertainty. And the one thing I will tell you about economics, and I think anybody will, you don't have to be an economist, you don't have to have a PhD. In fact, you can just be a little bubba, poor old Hayseed in Wyoming, and know this. When people are uncertain, they don't buy. Uncertainty is not the friend of a healthy economy. And the more you see of this political turmoil, and the more you... Oh, the other thing we have... Thank you for reminding me, producer. The other thing that we have going that we've never had before, at least in our lifetimes, is trade wars. And they have to be waged. I mean, it's either bite the bullet now or get a cannon shell up our butts down the road. The economic battles with Europe and Canada and Mexico and China particularly have got to be fought and won now. Trump is 100% right. But it's different. It is a different ingredient in the economic recipe than we've ever had before. And it's an ingredient which is in the recipe along with these other never-before-added ingredients to the economic pie. If you follow the markets, as I hope you do, if you've kept your eyes on those canaries in the economic mine I warned you of almost a year ago now, if you've watched those indicators in the real estate market, I'm talking about the residential real estate market, in your market area, wherever that is, whether you're listening to me in Seattle, Washington, or New York City, or Bangor, Maine, or Atlanta, Georgia, or West Virginia, or North Carolina, wherever, Wyoming, Colorado, it doesn't matter. Because some things about economy is universal. In almost every market, you will see, number one, the inventory has gone up over the last 6 months, and certainly over the last 90 days. Number two, the rate of sales, the amount of sales, is down, particularly in the kind of upper, middle, upper ends. Number three, the days on the market, DOM in realtor speak, have lengthened, in some cases tripled. And number four, in some markets like the Northeast, prices have begun to decline. That's going to continue, folks. And every rise in interest rate is going to accelerate that. And yes, there are certain types of real estate that are going to be far less impacted than others. Unique pieces of productive and or recreational ranch and farmland, particularly within a 3-hour radius of a major metropolitan area. Really good income-producing properties. And by really good, I don't mean retail centers because, you know, they face a long-term decline because of the online stuff. But in terms of certain types of office buildings, certain types of commercial buildings, certain types of residential buildings, particularly, you know, nice multifamily buildings, 2 units, 4 units, 8 units, smaller, maintainable, in good neighborhoods. Because obviously, people have to have a roof. And if they can't buy, they got to rent. So there's pockets within the storm that's coming in real estate. But if you have a home and you want to sell that home, may I suggest you get it on the market. I would not wait. And if you want to buy a home, you know, you might do better renting right now than buying. Fortunately, there's only a couple million of you that listen to me and listen to these podcasts. So the other 348 million Americans, or 347.5 million Americans, whatever our listenership is up to this week, they won't hear this show. So there's plenty of buyers and sellers out there who are still going to buy and who are still going to wait to sell. So don't despair. I'm not giving away any secrets here. It's just between us. The other thing that you need to do, and I've been harping on this, if you have credit card debt, pay it off. Zero. Zero out those cards. In fact, unless you absolutely, positively must have them, cut up every card but one to use just as an emergency. And let me emphasize something that I've told you a million times. I am not your financial advisor. I am not some financial guru. I have a boatload of experience in a boatload of places doing a boatload of things that I am nationally known for. So this is experience talking to you. It's free advice. You know what free advice is worth. But you do whatever is good for you. And I would also add that every person listening to me here is different. Some of you have a whole bunch of money in the bank. Some of you don't have any money in the bank. Some of you have stocks. Some of you don't. Many of you, I hope, have some type of retirement plan. I'm sure there's folks who listen to me that do not. Some of you have protected yourself with alternative investments like silver and gold and whatever. Some of you have not. Some of you have kids you have to put through college. Some of you are done with that or don't have kids. Some of you own your own places or own your own ranches or farms. Some of you may rent. Some of you may live in motorhomes. I have a bunch of listeners I know. They live in their motorhomes. They spend the north or they spend the summer times up north on their 20-acre deal out on a lake in Montana or wherever, and they spend their winter south in the desert in Arizona or Texas or Nevada. And their home is their motorhome. Good for you. The gypsies. The gypsies of 2019. But whatever your personal situation, getting rid of your credit card debt, getting rid of your vehicle debt, getting rid of all that debt that's kind of not investment debt, it would be a really good thing to do. And particularly if your debt is floating rate debt. In other words, it can move up or down and doesn't have a floor and doesn't have a ceiling. In other words, there's no point at which it must stop rising in your loan documents, because variable rate debt could get very, very, very expensive. How many of you listening to this show, and I'm sure there's a number of you, how many of you remember 18%, that's 1/8, not 1.8, but 1/8, 18% mortgage rates? That was back in the 70s, folks. Good old Jimmy Carter. 18% mortgage rates. And it could happen again. It depends how tight that money supply gets. And it depends how much the Federal Reserve ratchets up those interest rates. And if you think mortgage debt at 18% is expensive, hold on to your butts if you have a variable rate credit card or other type of finance. You could be paying 35, 36, 40, who knows what percent. And most of those big companies, they've found some slinky way to get around usury laws in most states. So that's not going to help you much either. Way better to have all that stuff paid off so you can't get caught. Because, you know, when rates go up to 18% for a house, or they go up to 35 or 40% for a credit card, there's not a lot of people that can pay off both the interest and the principal. So way better to get it taken care of now. And the other thing that I think you want to do, And I'm going to get into this in just a moment to give you a little background. The other thing that I think you ought to do is you ought to figure out a place to take money, if you control it, that's in the stock market. Remember, you know, the market's down 20% over the last several months. But the market's still up 30% over the last 2 years, even with the decline over the last 2 months. And, you know, there's an old saying, you never go broke making a profit. Okay, well, you know, your stocks went down 20% in the last 2 months. They're still up 30% from 2 years ago. Nobody ever went broke making a profit. You might want to think about getting into positions that are part of the long-term macro trend, and you might want to think about getting really liquid. That means getting out of most stock positions smartly, not in a panic, and putting that cash in some safe place, which is not necessarily a bank. I mean, that's a whole other discussion. You know, in a good piece of land. And if you pay cash for it, so much the better. Or a good multifamily rental unit that's in decent shape, or if you're a handyman that you can fix up that's in a good or coming neighborhood. Or something like that. Once again, I'm not your financial advisor. I'm giving you the facts I gave you on the economy are the facts. How you interpolate them and how you apply them to your personal and unique, because everybody's situation is unique, kettle of life fish, that's up to you. Or if you apply them at all. Maybe you think I'm cracked, right? The good times are going to roll on forever, man. Never going to be a downturn. Everything's going to be cool. No problem. All right. But I will tell you listeners that you have, I won't call it advance warning, you have advanced thoughts. You have a series of facts, a bunch of dots, you can connect them any way you want, way, way, way in advance of most Americans by listening to this show. And if you believe in them, or even if you believe in part of them, apply it to your personal situation and act accordingly. Not only do you owe it to yourself, you owe it to your family, you owe it to your children and your children's children, and you know what? You owe it to your country. Because what I'm about to go into now is a preview of the radical left when it's in power. And only if all us bubbas, us deplorables, us bitter clingers, if we are self-reliant, that means we can fight for America. If we're worried about where the next penny or breadcrumb or gallon of gas is going to come from, then we're not quite in the same position. So it all kind of ties in. You, your family, your country. So the Democratic House of Representatives convened day before yesterday, Thursday, for one day. Before they voted to give themselves a four-day break. Wow, unbelievable. Middle of a government shutdown. And may I add, this is government shutdown. First of all, it's, you know, it's totally hyped. Totally hyped. This is nonsense. Yeah, I feel moderately sorry for the 800,000 federal folks who aren't getting their checks. But I don't feel that badly for them. You know, they can get unemployment benefits, which they have to repay when they start getting their checks, but probably won't. They're getting paid 2 to 2.5 times more than workers doing comparable jobs in the private sectors. Their benefits package and pension, assuming there is a pension when this is all said and done, is 2.5 to 3 times a comparable private sector employee of similar rank would get out there in the real world. And while I'm sure they have their woes, you know, how do they pay their mortgage? How do they do this? How do they do that? You know, if they didn't have a nest egg put away, that was their decision. If they spent the money on new cars, new trucks, motorhome, whatever they spent their money on, that's their decision. And while I wince at the temporary pain of those 800,000 Americans. That's 800,000 Americans out of 350 million. And those 800,000 Americans aren't going to have to worry about much if this country falls apart or if the government goes broke because it's spending $1 trillion a year on illegal aliens. So their sacrifice is for the greater good. And prior to their sacrifice and after their sacrifice, they will be compensated handsomely. Far better, far more than any of us who work out here in the real world called the private sector. And as far as I'm concerned, Donald Trump can keep this government, quote unquote, shut down. It really isn't. Shut down forever. I don't care. In fact, if it's shut down next, I think it's what, September? Yeah, I think most of the government, 75% of the government is already funded through September because Paul Ryan is such a rhino skunk. So he didn't leave that bargaining chip on the table. If this rolls into next September, I don't care. In fact, if he shuts down the entire government, other than Department of Homeland Security and Defense, next September, and he shuts it down until the 2020 elections, I don't care. The problem on the southern border must be resolved, and it must be resolved in favor of the American nation. And the American nation, folks, you libs who listen to me are just quivering. Oh, my God, this is white nationalist. Yeah, you're just gagging on yourself. So let me explain. The American nation is anybody and everybody of any gender, ability, or disability, of any skin color, or from any planet, so long as they came here legally and went through the process. They can be an American with antennas. They can be a gay, lesbian, transgender, cross-dresser with a combination of black, white, and Hispanic parents and ancestry from Mars. If they came here legally or they were born here properly, they are Americans. And they are part of the American nation. And that border wall down there and all the things that go along with it, the elimination of the visa lottery, the revamping of the visa system, the enforcement of visa overstays, the complete revamping of this absolute BS Barry Obama conjured amnesty law, deportation, dismantling of the sanctuary systems and the defunding of sanctuary cities and states and counties. This is all part of the package. And unless that's done, you and I and them, that mystical, very diverse, you know, very diverse American from another planet, from three different entirely racial parents and grandparents, not knowing what sex they are and engaging in whatever activities they engage in, that American too, along with us, we're done. There won't be an American nation. There won't be an America. And there won't be Americans. That's how critical this is. And shutting down the federal government and the inconvenience that may cause, even if for every American for a time being, and certainly for a few Americans for a short while, is well worth it. Let me tell you what we face in terms of the radical left in power. In the one day, this is the 8 to 10 hours, whatever it was on Thursday, that Nancy Pelosi's, 161st, whatever Congress it is, the whackball Congress, let me tell you what happened in that day. The night before, Tlaib, a Muslim elect Congress lady from Michigan, Speaking to a MoveOn.org, gee, how amazing, party, said that she was going to Washington to impeach that mother effer. Speaking of Donald Trump. Only a few Democrats castigated her for that. Most did not, including Nancy Pelosi, who dodged a reporter's questions and said, oh, you know, I don't censor my members. Ocasio-Cortez, you know, this gal that I brought her to your attention long before the rest of the press did. This is way back in the primaries. Remember that show? Those of you who listened to kind of my run-up to the election stuff? When she won the primary from the four-time whatever Democratic congressman because, you know, he thought he couldn't lose. And she won it by 3,000 votes. With like a 10% or 15% turnout of the total electorate. I mean, she was clever. Give her credit. And she won. Give her credit. But she's the darling of the Democratic Party. She's like she's like the co-speaker of the House. I'm sure Nancy Pelosi bites her Botox lips over the whole Ocasio-Cortez thing. So this gal who won her primary by 3,000 votes out of like 25,000 cast is in an all-blue district. I mean, it's like 98% blue. And who then got elected because she was like the only one on the ballot. She's like the spokesperson for the Democratic Party and everybody thinks she's like God. All the left-wing news media, the mainstream media. I mean, they have her on, and she's spouting about this and spouting about that. She, number one, likened herself. I can't make this up. She compared herself to Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt because they were radicals, and she's radical, too. And she proposed increasing income taxes, although she's quick to say just on the very rich, to 70%. Now, folks, think about if the Democrats raise taxes successfully to 70% on what they call the very rich, a subjective term, what do you think they're going to try to do with your taxes and my taxes and your children's taxes? You think they're going to be satisfied with just raising it to 70% of the quote-unquote very rich? I don't think so. Nope. And another congressman from Connecticut, some gal got elected there in Connecticut, she suggested that along with that tax increase to 70%, that means, by the way, folks, to boil it down for you, you'd be working till August, late August, mid-September every year before any money went into your pocket. From January until late August or mid-September, you were working for the government. Kind of put that in perspective for you. So this gal from Connecticut, I mean, you know, this tax idea is so terrific. This take the money from one and spread it out to the other, particularly if the other's going to vote for you. She proposed raising the 0.5% Obamacare tax that everybody pays. Jeez. Nice job, Paul Ryan, not getting rid of that. And Mitch. She proposed raising that to 4%. So now we'd be at a 74% tax rate on the federal level. Terrific. Great. And then, of course, you have state taxes, property taxes, city taxes, whatever happens to be going on in your area. I think some of the pundits, and I think they're low, figured it'd be like 86% if you worked in New York. It'd be like 83% if you were in California. Okay. In other words, you work basically to about almost Thanksgiving. Just about Thanksgiving. And then from Thanksgiving until New Year's, whatever you make is yours. Terrific. The other 11 months of the year, that's you're working for the government. You're working to support those illegal aliens coming across the border who cost $70,000 a year each. Yeah, okay. I really like that idea. Then there's this guy, God, I forget his name, but you've seen him. He's kind of bald, thin, from California, absolutely quietly obnoxious. I can't stand listening to any of these people. He introduced articles of impeachment. I mean, the whole Democratic Party during the whole midterm was saying, oh, no, we're not running on impeachment. We're not going to impeach. We're not going to blah, 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 blah. The first day, folks, like in the first hours, the articles of impeachment for Donald Trump are introduced based on obstruction of justice because he fired Comey. Oh, yeah, yay. Man, do these people even read the newspapers? Then, you'll love this. By the way, on that tax thing, did you know that 50% of America, as of today, only pays 3% of the tax that runs this country? 50% pay 3%. The other 50% pay 97%. And the further you go up the economic ladder, the steeper that gets. And then we found out from a whole bunch of people, including Crazy Maxine Waters, et cetera, there's like 85 different subpoenas going out from 5 or 6 different committees to like everybody from Trump down to Trump's dog. You know, they want to know which Petco the dog went to, and they want all his receipts. And they want to know about any vet tests of his stools. And then there was a bill introduced. This is a very busy day, you know. Then there was a bill introduced, you'll love this, to change the Electoral College so that we would be change the Constitution, basically, a constitutional amendment to change the Electoral College to a popular vote. And, of course, it doesn't take a lot to connect the dots here. Let's see. On one hand, they don't want to fund a wall because, number one, we know a wall works. Wherever it's up, it works. Israel, our southern border, our northern border, between Pakistan and India, Hungary. I mean, there's another dozen examples of where walls really work. And, you know, walls are permanent. I mean, kind of when if they're built right, they're kind of there. And all this nonsense about the Democrats, oh, well, we could have technology and drones. Well, that doesn't stop anything. And by the stroke of a pen, as Obama demonstrated, he could just say, shut down the drones. But you can't say, make the wall invisible, which is why they don't want a wall. If you take that dot of they don't want a wall, and you add in the dot of also on Thursday, you're going to love this. The Democrats passed this spending bill with no money for the wall, a paltry $1 billion or $600 million, whatever it was, for who knows what quote-unquote border security that's not worth squat. But with $12 billion, that's $12 billion of foreign aid for other countries. Think about that. Not a penny for the wall for the American people, economics, safety, drugs, immigration, burdens on the entitlement system, transformation of the demographics of the United States, voter fraud. Who cares about that stuff? Poor legal immigrant cops getting shot 1 hour after Christmas after leaving his 5-month-old son. Girls getting raped by illegal aliens. Take a look at the immigration articles. That were deported 8 times before. Kate Steinle getting shot on this. I mean, don't worry about that, folks. Let's send $12 billion to other countries. If you take all these dots, and then you take the dot of the Democrats howling about the fact there is no voter fraud, and there shouldn't be any IDs, and you add in the Project Veritas undercover stuff, undercover videos I talked about last week with election officials freely admitting in Texas and elsewhere that illegal aliens were voting and telling illegal aliens it was fine to vote as long as you had, like, your driver's license or some type of ID we don't check. The rampant voter fraud and criminal election fraud that was perpetrated in Florida. Listen to my show on that. I think it was 3-4 weeks ago, where there was 1.2 million more votes counted than could have been cast under the most optimistic of midterm voting circumstances. And couple that with one bright light in the voter fraud story, which is this Judicial Watch I mentioned at the beginning of the show. They just won a lawsuit in L.A. County, which forces, think about this, L.A. County to purge their voter rolls of anybody who has moved away, dead, whatever. Which, by the way, is federal law that it be done every year. L.A. County has not done it for 20 years. There are 3.5 million more people on the voting rolls than the census shows there are people eligible to vote in L.A. County. If you remember correctly, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in large part due to a 2.5 million vote surplus in L.A. County. And Donald Trump told you that there were millions of illegal and fraudulent votes in the 2016 election, and I gave you the figure of 5 million. Well, folks, there you go. So L.A. County is going to have to purge at least 1.5 million names off their voter rolls, which they haven't done for 20 years. I wonder why. I wonder why they actually went to court to fight about having to comply with a federal law that they haven't complied with for 20 years. Think about that. It certainly was not for lack of cost, because the attorney's fees were far more than the cost of purging the voter rolls. If you put all these dots together, what do you come up with? I mean, it kind of slaps you in the face like a dead smelly fish, doesn't it? What the Democrats want is the Democrat democracy. They don't want us to be a constitutional republic. They want a straight democracy, which is rule by the mob, rule by the majority. No safeguards for the minority at all, which is exactly what the Electoral College, if you read the Federalist Papers, was designed to do. The House of Representatives is elected, basically, one person for 750,000, one representative for 750,000 voters or people. The Senate is elected, used to be elected by the state legislatures. It's now elected by popular vote within each state. Even Wyoming, with 500,000 people, has two senators, just like New York does with 40-whatever million people, or California with 35 million people. That was the founders' way of equalizing the playing field, making sure the urban areas did not swamp the suburban areas, which, by the way, was one of the big hang-ups at the time of the writing and signing of the Constitution between the South, which was rural, and the North, which was urban, and was actually one of the precipitators of the Civil War, which, while, yes, over slavery to some extent, was, in many Southerners' minds, over states' rights. I reference Beauregard, the famous general from Louisiana. He didn't have slaves. He didn't believe in slavery. He believed in states' rights. 10th Amendment. If you take all this stuff together, it is apparent that the Democrats will do and take any step, wipe out the Constitution, wipe out parts of the Constitution, voter fraud, transformation of America through rampant illegal immigration, and thereafter voting by illegal aliens, legalization of voting by felons. They will do anything to get power and maintain it. The other fun things that happened in the very first day of Nancy Pelosi's circus. There was a draft bill introduced. It's not on the floor yet. It's just in committee to abolish ICE. There was a long speech by some guy on the congressional floor citing all sorts of facts, which were not facts. They were completely false. I mean, I don't know if this guy's ever cracked a history book or whatever, about how the Republican Party was the Nazi Party and Donald Trump was Hitler, and just like Hitler had taken over the Nazi Party in Germany, Trump had taken over the Republican Party. What you get the gist. Oh, and then Jennifer Wexton from Virginia's 10th District. One of the districts, by the way, one of the 26 congressional seats that was stolen through criminal electioneering by the Democrats. Next to the flag outside of her office, there's another flag. It's the transgender flag. I'm not putting a picture of it up on the website. If you're curious, you can Google it up. Jennifer Wexton, Virginia 10th Congressional District flag. I'm sure you will get the picture. And then we have the Muslim gal who was elected from Minnesota. And this is the gal who went to her swearing-in ceremony wrapped in a Palestinian flag. She didn't wear it during the ceremony, but she refused to take the oath on the Bible. Instead, she took it on the Quran, and the House voted, this is on their first day, folks, to change a 186-year-old rule. I mean, that's like almost like back to the House of Representatives' very beginning, that no headgear of any type, no yarmulke, no Indian headdress, no nothing, was allowed on the floor of the House of Representatives. The House, which is the Democrats, is voting to change that rule to allow her to wear her hijab. How nice. And over in the Senate, good old Kyrsten Sinema, from Arizona, who stole that election, along with her corrupt Democratic cronies in Arizona, from Martha McSally, who in the end got to be a senator anyway, appointed by the governor to take the place of Kyle. Sinema, you'll love this. I mean, if you saw any of the tapes of this gal, how she could be elected is unfathomable. I mean, you just can't believe it. Of course, since there were, after the polls closed, suddenly 300,000, with McSally leading, by the way, by 35,000 votes. And suddenly, within the days thereafter, there were 300,000 votes just discovered. Oh, gee, where did they come from? Oh, every vote has to be counted. You remember that chant? And so Sinema winds up winning by 10,000 votes. Sinema, baby, she decided that she just couldn't take the oath on the Bible. Literally. And I understand it was quite a scene there with with Dan Pence administering the oath, because Dan Pence is kind of a Bible guy. But from what I understand, she actually took the oath of office without her hand on the Bible or Quran or anything. And I'm not sure that's ever been done before. And I could go on, folks. I mean, that's kind of like part of the first day of the new Democratic circus on Capitol Hill. But I think it gives you an idea of what we got coming this year. And I think it gives you a really good idea of what we face if the loony left ever really gets power. Having one House of Congress is a huge problem, but it's not power. Let's get into Romney. Because, in addition to these Looney Tunes, radical, unbelievable, in the ozone folks who are now in the House, now running the House of Representatives, and some of their compatriots over in the Senate, like Sinema, we have the Never Trumpers. We have Mitt Romney, who the day before he takes the oath at the Senate, pens an op-ed in the Washington Post, ripping Trump a new butt, because he just isn't worthy of the mantle of the presidency. Because Mitt is so pious and so sanctimonious and so perfect and so angelic. I was a pretty big supporter of Mitch up to about 2 weeks before he lost to Obama, because he stopped campaigning and because he just refused to go for the throat. If you remember back to that election, he had Obama on the ropes in that first debate. And then in the second debate, he totally blew it. And in the third debate, he was like a cowering dog. And he never went after Obama. He certainly never even came close to going after Obama like he goes after Trump. And supposedly the guy's a Republican. Well, we should have known better. He did Romney Care in Massachusetts before he moved to Utah. He signed, by the way, an assault weapons ban in Massachusetts. Most people don't know that. And then, of course, on the national campaign, talked about how he was absolutely against any gun control and all for the Second Amendment, blah, 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 blah. He's one of the Republicans we have to really keep our eyes on with federal gun control. We're going to be getting that in just a moment. But his speech, I was going to read you parts of it, but it's just too unbelievable. Dial up Mitt Romney, op-ed Washington Post. You can read it for yourself. You'll just shake your head. In the middle of this shutdown, before he's even sworn in, with a battle literally for the future of America hanging in the balance on the southern border, and this guy is like off in the ozone. It's no wonder his running mate for Vice President, Paul Ryan, never got the border wall done. I don't think Romney wants a border wall. We know Ryan didn't. It's just beyond comprehension. As I have often said, the Never Trumpers, the Republican establishment, I think are worse enemies than the Democrats. At least you know where the Democrats and the loony left is coming from. It's particularly gruesome when you're stabbed in the back by somebody you think is at least your quasi-ally. By the way, I almost forgot. So this moron, in addition to Mitt Romney, this moron, Rick, whatever his name is, GOP strategist, Never Trumper, he's on CNN. And he's doing this rant about the border wall and how it doesn't work and how it's all a con and, you know, Donald Trump is a con man and yada, 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 yada. And in the course of it, he shows what these people really think. This is our new name, folks. We are the credulous ten-toothers. Yeah, well, you know, if you count the teeth in your head, you'll see that you have, I don't know, what is it, 30 or something, give or take. I never have sat there and counted my teeth. But the inference is that all our teeth are falling out and that we are dumber than rocks. So in addition to bitter clingers, deplorables, skanks, misogynists, racists, homophobes, Islamophobes, and whatever else, you already know, we are now the credulous ten-toothers. Oh, my. And we're going to rely on these folks, these quote-unquote Republicans, to protect our rights, get rid of voter fraud, secure the southern border, and protect our Second Amendment and our right to keep and bear arms, which shall, according to the Constitution, not be infringed. Yeah. Okay. So let me tell you now about what's happening with gun control around the country. I'm just going to give you some snippets. In Washington State, we'll start off with like kind of the state and local and then go to the federal. In Washington State, there was a referendum. It passed by 59%. That's scary. Nobody under 21 can now buy a semi-automatic rifle in the state of Washington. The Attorney General of Washington, emboldened, he's a raving lefty, is now coming up with more stuff, limiting capacity, magazine capacities to 10 rounds, banning all assault weapons. By the way, the definition of the Washington State Attorney General of an assault weapon is any semi-automatic rifle, I'm paraphrasing, which has at least one feature which makes it shoot faster or more accurately. That's the definition of an assault rifle. And additionally, by the way, that was Initiative 1639. It's being challenged in the courts, but who knows what the outcome of that will be. There are a number of other states who, over the last year, plus or minus, have also passed bans against anyone under 21 buying semi-automatic weapons, and in some cases, any weapon. They include Florida, New York, Hawaii, Illinois, and Vermont. One of the things which virtually all these states are looking at, and a bunch of other blue states, Rhode Island, where some other gun laws just got passed, kind of similar to these, is what they call the safe storage laws. You know, the left is so good with coming up these warm, fuzzy terms and casting the argument before you ever get it started. Safe storage laws. Basically, what the safe storage laws in now, I believe, 18 states, 18 states, folks, that's almost half of the country. The safe storage laws mandate that your weapons must be under lock and key. And, of course, there's pages and pages of what that means and what kind of locks and what kind of, you know, the typical government stuff. So if you have been sleeping with a gun under your mattress or under your pillow for self-defense at night in case there's a home invasion or whatever, in these states, you can't do that anymore. Your firearms have to remain under lock and key. And, of course, then you ask, well, how are they going to know? Well, here's how they would know. If any of your firearms are stolen, then you are liable for whatever is done with those firearms, number one. Number two, you're subject to a $10,000 fine. And number three, you can face up to 5 years in prison. That's your safe storage laws. And then a number of states, I believe also 18, have passed red flag laws. I'm going to tell you, let's take Illinois, for instance. Number one, Illinois, in their new gun laws, and you know how well they've worked in Chicago, right? There's been over 10,000 gunshot wounds, woundings or deaths over the last X years. There's like 436 or 463 gun-related homicides in Chicago last year, which, by the way, is hundreds of more than we have casualties in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria combined. So along with 10 other states and the District of Columbia, now 11 states, I'm sure you know, I don't think you are aware of what's been going on here. All gun purchases have to wait 72 hours, not 24 hours. None of the other gun buying requirements that were already on the books are being waived. Gun owners still have to apply for, and they have to present their what's called FOID card. Ever hear of these? Firearm Owner's Identification Card. It's kind of a crafty way to get your guns registered so they know who has the guns and what guns they have. That's the first step to confiscation. We're going to get there later, not too much later, but later in this show. As of June 1, 2019, the waiting period for 72 hours, this was for pistols right now, will be required for long guns. And anybody buying a gun or after they have purchased the gun, is subject to Illinois' red flag laws. Like I said, 18 other states now have, in one way, shape, or form, red flag laws. The red flag laws, once again, don't you love the way the left couches all this stuff? Basically, if any family or police or anybody, a jilted ex-girlfriend, a jilted ex-boyfriend, a annoyed spouse, whatever, a disgruntled teenager because he didn't like the fact he got grounded. I mean, it doesn't matter. They can go to the cops, and the cops have the absolute right, without due process, to come in and take all your guns. You have no hearing, you have no court, you have no defense. You have to surrender your weapons, or there's very stiff penalties. And then you got to spend months and thousands of dollars going to court to get those guns back. To prove that you are not a menace. To prove that your 17-year-old son or daughter was angry at you because they were grounded. Or that your annoyed spouse or jilted ex-lover or whatever was exactly that and you pose no threat to humanity. So that's Illinois. That's just two states. Connecticut is about to pass, they've already passed restrictions because of Sandy Hook. They're about to pass even more stringent restrictions. Rhode Island has passed restrictions. Maryland has passed restrictions. This is all in the last 180 days. On who can buy what guns might be outlawed, what guns are illegal, red flag laws, safe storage laws, and on, and magazine limitations. You may remember Colorado passed magazine limitations, what, 4, 5, 6 years ago? A sure sign that state was turning blue, by the way. There was, let's see. Oh, okay. So, in New Jersey just passed a law. It was upheld by a left-wing Obama judge. It's being appealed. The New Jersey law requires safe storage, has red flag, all that, and limits all magazines to a maximum capacity of 10 rounds. And there's a guy by the name, the attorney general there, Gerber Gruhl, whatever, Attorney General Gerber Gruhl of New Jersey. He tweeted out right after the court ruling that the Second Amendment infringements were legal. This just in, for months, individuals have been challenging New Jersey's limits on large capacity magazines, a sensible law to address mass shootings. Today, the Court of Appeals upheld the law. Big win for public safety and law enforcement safety. The residents of New Jersey, folks, were given until December 11th, that's 3 weeks ago, to turn in all their standard capacity magazines, you know, more than 10 rounds. And what the law really did is it made 1 million, an estimated million to million and a half gun owners in New Jersey into criminals if they failed to turn in the magazines. Well, guess what? virtually no one, like we're talking less than 200 people out of the million or million and a half who are known to have standard capacity 15 round to 20 round magazines have turned in their magazines. And you know, that's civil disobedience I can get right behind. Because you have almost the obligation to disobey a law which is contrary to the Constitution. In fact, the Constitution itself gives you that right. So now you got a million to a million and a half people in New Jersey who obviously have guns and have 15 to 20 round magazines for those guns, who are not abiding by the whims of the ultra-progressive legislature of the state of New Jersey and the quibbles of its ultra-progressive Gerber, whatever his name is, attorney general, and the left-wing antics of its Democratic governor. And they're basically saying, come and get them. Now, I just don't think there's enough state police in the state of New Jersey to go out there and round up, nor do I think there's enough state police in the state of New Jersey who want to go out there and round up illegal magazines from 1 million to 1.5 million Second Amendment supporters with semi-automatic weapons and at least one 15 to 20 round clip. Going to be kind of interesting to see how that plays out. But in the meantime, the law was passed, which is what this segment was about. Bump stocks. You know, I kind of vacillate myself on bump stocks. First of all, I don't see where they really do anything. Anybody who's ever shot a weapon with a bump stock, yeah, you can get off a lot of rounds, but, you know, they're wildly inaccurate. I mean, the very motion of the gun to make the guns, the bump stock work against the trigger to create an automatic effect out of a semi-automatic rifle makes them a very unstable firing platform with very little accuracy. So I am not, you know, in a situation like Las Vegas, and by the way, I'm going to have some updated information for you in Las Vegas next week. I mean, I told you I wasn't going to let that story go. My antenna have been buzzing on that ever since the first night, all the conflicting reports, the lack of information, the lack of, I mean, something really stinks at that mass shooting in Las Vegas a year ago, October 1. 58 people killed, 500 or more wounded. In that situation where you have a bump stock and you're firing kind of indiscriminately into a big crowd, yeah, the bump stock's going to allow you to do more damage. But even the federal government is into banning bump stocks now. And to my partial surprise, Trump is backing it. So that's another little piece of gun control legislation coming down. There is, boy, I wish I was done, but I'm not even close to done here. All right, so now there's Maryland. Passed a red flag law. In fact, on November 5th, at 5 a.m. on a Monday, two police officers went to collect the guns of a veteran, 61-year-old, his name was Gary Willis, because somebody, and the story is foggy on this, said he was a menace or he was angry or he was whatever that the person made up. The guy had no prior record, had not done anything, had made no threats against anyone, had a clean social media. Yeah, I mean, you know, he just was not your typical potential shooter. But Willis, some kind of struggle ensued. I guess Willis was not willing to part with his guns. And Willis, unarmed, was shot and killed by one of the cops. So there's another side of a red flag law. By the way, the Republican governor there in Maryland, his name is Hogan, signed these gun bills on April 24th, 2018. By the way, in the very first year, there were 62 red flag requests to confiscate people's guns. I don't have any stats for you yet on how many of them got them back, proving that the complaint or the concern or the whatever was illegitimate to begin with. And now we have red flag laws being drafted, believe it or not, on a bipartisan basis in Congress. I'm going to get into that in just a moment. You need to know what's happening at the federal level. I'm just giving you a taste of some of the things at the state level. There is there's a whole set of things coming down from corporate America. You know, this started really with Eric Holder in what was called Operation Choke Point. Another scandal of the Obama administration. You know, that administration which Obama says was scandal-free. And what Eric Holder did was illegally and unconstitutionally go to banks and credit unions and businesses and put the screws on them and say, you know, we don't want to have to send federal examiners in there and do a big audit of the bank and yada, yada, yada. So why don't you just make sure you don't do business with the NRA or any gun shop or any gun manufacturer, and then, you know, we'll kind of leave you alone. In other words, it was extortion. And that was called Operation Choke Point. But that got the ball rolling, as seemed to be the case with many of Barry's initiatives, unfortunately. And then with the Parkland shooting, I'm going to talk about that in just a moment, down in Florida, and the left very cleverly using the Parkland children, including the obnoxious David Hogg, as their shields, they started this discussion, which has led to these red flag laws and the laws in Florida and Hawaii and Illinois and Vermont, etc. I mean, Parkland was really the, things were drifting in this direction for a long time. Parkland was really kind of the match to the fuse, so to speak. And the irony of it, I'm going to step back for and talk about something else for just a moment, tied in. The irony is that the report just came out in Parkland, and as we knew from day one, this 84-page report by a blue-ribbon nonpartisan council that just came out, it came to four basic conclusions. Number one, the school board was completely unprepared. Number two, the sheriff's department, you know, that scummy sheriff down there, was completely unprepared. Number three, that federal laws, which allowed student crimes to go unreported, this was an Obama deal. If you go back to my show in Parkland, I spend a long segment explaining how this kid who perpetrated that shooting was visited by the cops 29 times prior to the shooting, how there were warnings given to the FBI and everything else that he was going to do it, and nothing happened to him. That was an Obama-specific policy, which rewarded school districts for not reporting crimes by students. I mean, I'm summing it up. Trump, by the way, has reversed that law. He has struck that executive order from the books. Thank goodness. And the third thing, or fourth, whatever it happens to be, that they came up with was that the officer on duty, Peterson, the only armed person at the high school other than the shooter, was, and they use very strong terms, basically they call him a dirty coward for not going in there and confronting the shooter. In a related matter, a lawsuit brought against Broward County and the school district and the sheriff's department was dismissed by a Florida judge, although that's being appealed, because the Florida judge ruled, a lefty, of course, a Florida judge ruled that the sheriff's department and Mr. Peterson, the cowardly deputy who did not go into the gunfire and allowed the shooter to run amok for 15 minutes and to even leave the premises, they did not have the duty to protect. I want you to think about that. A court has ruled that the sheriff's department had no duty, and Scott and this Peterson guy had no duty to go in there and protect the students and save their lives. That they could at their discretion, but they didn't have to. I want you to think about that. I mean, that boggles the mind. The last thing that this report came up with, of its major findings, was that arming willing teachers who took mental tests, fitness tests, and who were extensively trained in the use of firearms and the use of firearms in a shooter or deadly situation would definitely have saved lives, and they recommended that teachers be armed immediately. Not mandatory for every teacher, only on a volunteer basis, but there goes the left's whole argument against arming teachers. As an interesting sidelight to this, to the Parkland thing, we find out that Peterson, the coward who did not go, run to the sound of the guns, but instead hid outside while the students who trusted him for their safety were getting shot inside. We find out that Peterson buried a report about the Broward County Sheriff's son being the perpetrator of a sexual assault on school grounds. I want you to think about that. The sheriff's department that so blew this, the scumbag sheriff that sat on all these national TV shows and berated the NRA and tried to cast the blame on others, who trained his deputies not to go in, who allowed Peterson to retire, even in disgrace, with a $100,000 plus a year pension. His son was a recipient not only of the incredibly unbelievable Obama executive order that said school districts get rewarded for not turning kiddie criminals in, but Peterson doctored the report of this sheriff's, Israel is his name, Sheriff Israel, of Sheriff Israel's son's sexual assault on another student to shield the sheriff's son. And it's pretty clear that Peterson suffered no ramifications whatsoever for his cowardice, for allowing students to die when he could have almost definitely saved lives, by cowering outside with his own weapon drawn, doing nothing, not even allowing the other sheriff deputies to go in. It's pretty clear that he's getting that pension. He got off the hook because he helped Sheriff Israel out with his wayward criminal son. It looks like the new governor of Florida, DeSantis, is going to remove Israel from his office. Thank God. And then the guy needs to be prosecuted, along with Peterson. You know, people have to be held accountable. But that's the Parkland report. So I want to step back and give you some background here. Because the event that precipitated all these laws that gave the left a foothold, a rallying cry, and afforded them the opportunity to use these kids as kind of the point of the spear of gun control, was found out to be completely avoidable, was in large part due to completely inept government bungling at the federal, state, and county level, and at the sheriff's department, to a cowardice by a sheriff's deputy who was in cahoots with the sheriff to shield the sheriff's son from a sexual assault charge, and who hid the whole thing behind an Obama executive order, which created the situation in which the shooter, after being visited by 29 times by the same sheriff's department, was allowed to get his hands on a gun and to get into that school. I mean, that's the event which has precipitated all these laws. It's just unbelievable. It's almost as ridiculous and as far-fetched and as astounding in its own way as is the dossier paid for by Hillary Clinton, put together by a foreign national British spy, Christopher Steele, using drummed-up crap from Russian KGB agents, precipitating the special counsel investigation and the FISA warrants in that whole Trump-Mueller mess. How the left is able to take situations like this, which are so factual in nature, which are so in your face with common sense conclusions, which are borne out by subsequent investigations as to be complete nonsense, complete contrived political crap, how these things are allowed to push forward the conjuring of a crisis to deprive Americans of their rights and justice is just breathtaking. Breathtaking. And I might add, it could not happen without Rhino help. Which brings us to the next deal. I started talking about Holder's Operation Choke Point. Well, the government and the deep state and the left has run with that concept. And using the Parkland kids, again, as their foils and shields, all sorts of pressure has been brought to bear on rental car companies like Avis and Hertz, who have cut their ties with the NRA. Certain cooler companies, I believe it's Igloo, have cut their ties with the NRA. Other banks like Citibank and Chase Bank have refused to do business or renew credits and financing for gun manufacturers and gun stores. The list is really quite alarmingly long. In other words, the government has enlisted corporations to, in effect, impose gun control, which lets the politicians off the hook because they don't have to vote. They can hide behind the twist, the coercion they've used to get corporate America to step into the gun control arena and not have to take a vote, which their constituency would see is clearly anti-Second Amendment. I mean, it's really diabolical. Really diabolical. Chris Murphy, Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, he's been instrumental in this. He's posted all sorts of threats on social media and to social media companies about gun advertising and gun this and gun that. Basically intimating that they would be under investigation for this, that, and the other, the color of their mother's skirt, if they didn't stop running gun ads and take down gun sites and, you know, delist or change the algorithms of Second Amendment groups. This is scary stuff, folks. John Kennedy, he's a Republican senator from Louisiana, and he just proposed the Red and Blue Banks Act. Quote, prohibit the federal government from giving contracts to banks that discriminate against lawful businesses based solely on social policy considerations. So there's some Republican pushback to this, but the guy is like all alone. I almost start stuttering when I start looking at this stuff. It's just so underhanded. It's such subterfuge. It is so un-American. It is so anti-Constitution. And it is so anti-you and me, anti-American public. But it's going to continue, okay? And you're going to see more and more companies falling into line. Look at Nike, perfect example. Nike is a company you shouldn't do business with, folks. Don't buy their sneakers. They're totally anti-Second Amendment. And I think maybe I'll put together a list. It's like, it's long and strong. Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. Don't buy their policies. They're anti-Second Amendment. They withdrew support from Laura Ingraham. And I can go on and on. And then we get, finally, we've come from the local to the state to corporate America under the push of the federal government. We come to the federal government itself. Okay, so Democrat Senators Dick Durbin and Chuck Schumer, they wrote a bill which is unbelievably is being backed by some Republicans, including Chuck Grassley. Wow. Which makes it illegal for anybody to print a 3D gun and for anybody to share information about how to print a 3D gun on any medium whatsoever, including the internet. And the penalty is a minimum, let me underline this, minimum of 5 years. Now, this is the same time that the Senate, and these three senators voted for it, is passing criminal reform, which lets all sorts of insundry and scurrilous people out of jail early. I mean, there are people who have been in jail for a year for, like, aggravated assault with intent to sell deadly drugs who are going to be getting out of jail. But if you share information on how to build a gun, or you build a gun, you can go to jail for a minimum, underline minimum, of 5 years. Pretty amazing. And they tried to tack this onto the prison reform bill. I'm doing some research as to what exactly happened with it. And they base it on the ITAR, I-T-A-R, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. You know, here's that globalism crap again. Gun Owners of America, by the way, GOA, is fighting this, and another organization that deserves your support, I might add. Communicating how-to information on the internet with respect to any guns on what they call the munitions list is a minimum 5 years in prison. 8 states have now successfully sued to criminalize over 100,000, think about that, 100,000 different downloads of different types of instructions for making a gun from a 3D printer. The Senate bill side of this, the House bill I gave you, H.R. 8682, the Senate bill side is S1917. You might want to call your senators and find out what's going on with this bill and if that amendment, call it the ITAR amendment, was actually put on there. But that'll give you an idea. And by the way, that's an example of, you would never expect Chuck Grassley of Iowa to be involved in that bill, but he is. There's 4 Republicans, actually, Grassley's not one of them, who are currently in the Senate that you got to keep a really close eye on any of these gun bills, folks. Maybe 5, actually. Any of them could screw the pooch on your Second Amendment rights. Number one, you have Mitt Romney just coming into the Senate. I mean, we know where he stands. He signed an assault weapons ban in Massachusetts and then lied about his Second Amendment love while he was running unsuccessfully. Gee, how'd you do that, Mitt? Against Barack Obama in 2012. Rick Scott from Florida, and I happen to like Rick Scott a lot. But remember, Rick Scott did sign a law in Florida which banned 21-year-olds from buying rifles or semi-automatic weapons, which instituted red flag laws, which instituted longer waiting periods, and other gun restrictions. And then we have Marco Rubio, also of Florida. He's actually co-sponsoring a red flag bill at the federal level. Think about how scary that is. Think about a government, folks. Now, you already know what they think of us, right? We are the skanks, the deplorables, the bitter clingers, the misogynists, the racists, the dumb whatevers, and, of course, the credulous ten-toothers now. Just think what would happen if you had a federal government that had the power to take a complaint from anybody or perhaps conjure up its own complaint about you being unfit to have a weapon. And, you know, it's not too hard to figure out who the deplorables are, right? You can go to voter register. I mean, let's face it, it can be done in a heartbeat. And let's say they wanted to kind of pick off all the Second Amendment rights folks, kind of one at a time over a long period of time. Remember, the left plays long ball. So they don't make a law saying it's illegal to have guns and you 100 million people are going to have to give up your weapons. I mean, that would be civil war overnight. What they say instead is, you, Joe, And you, Tom, you know, maybe they do 5,000 people in each and every state each and every month, one by one. Pretty scary stuff. And since the red flag laws are completely subjective, well, you know, Uncle Tom was using the different toothpaste this morning, and whenever he uses this other toothpaste, I can tell he's in a rage. I mean, I don't think he should have his guns right now. So, Rubio, baby, he is, he's co-sponsoring this federal red flag bill with Senators Manchin. It's too bad he didn't lose. Nelson, who now is not there anymore, but Scott has taken his place. And at that time, Harry Reid. Now there's another sponsor, which I believe is the senator from, I want to say Nevada. If you remember back to Rubio's televised appearance with that incredibly inept and nasty, corrupt Sheriff Israel, and David Hogg and several other Parkland students, and Dana Lash from the NRA, which was felt badly for her, on CNN. Marco, in that meeting, offered to sponsor bills banning magazines, raising the minimum age to buy an AR-15, expanding the NICS background check system, etc. I mean, he said it right on national TV. Then you have Representative Brian Mast. House of Representatives, Brian Mast, also a Republican from Florida. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times calling for a ban on America's most popular rifle, which is the AR-15. Actually, this Republican calling for a ban on a weapon. Then he co-sponsored a bill from California Democrats to give Department of Justice grants to states that impose red flag confiscation laws. So these 18 states that have red flag confiscation laws are getting grants from the Department of Justice. Oh, wow. Ted Deutsch, a Democratic, that's D-E-U-T-C-H, a Democratic congressman from, also from Florida. He happens to be in the Parkland district, by the way. Said Democrats, quote, will be focusing on bills with more bipartisan support, which includes bump stock bans and extreme risk protection orders, also known as red flag laws, which give law enforcement and family members a way to petition a court to temporarily bar an unstable person from buying or owning guns, unquote. Red flag laws, folks, are also called ERPOs, E-R-P-O. Extreme risk protection orders. Once again, don't you just love the left's nomenclature here? Yeah. Basically, what they do is they allow the authorities to seize a firearm from anyone who is deemed by anyone else for any reason without backup to be a threat to themselves or others. Basically, a simple accusation, family member, a friend, associate, that's all that's needed to seize somebody's firearms. You can see how dangerous this law is. And you can see how truly scary it is in the hands of the federal government, particularly if the federal government was controlled by a bunch of Looney Tunes, like just took over the House of Representatives. Okay? My earlier segment. You see how this all ties together. Lindsey Graham. Believe it or not, and Lindsey can be okay sometimes. Sometimes, you know, I just kind of shake my head. He introduced a red flag bill in the 115th Congress. And he's already said he's going to reach across the aisle to work with Democratic colleagues to move red flag legislation forward. Quote, this is the place where we begin a long overdue discussion about firearms and mental health, but we must start, unquote. All right, well, I think that gives you an idea of the things which are brewing. There's actual talk about, in the Democratic House, the new Looney Tunes Nancy Pelosi circus, There's actually talk about laws allowing gun confiscation. Of course, this is the same outfit that just put together the impeachment articles, the the constitutional amendment to change the electoral process, 4% Obamacare tax, blah, 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 blah. So, I just want to let you know, though, that actual gun confiscation, I don't know who they think they're going to get to come out and confiscate all these guns from the credulous 10-toothers, but that's actually under discussion in the very first day of Nancy Pelosi's Looney Tunes circus. I bring you this segment because you need to be aware at how, what a tidal wave, it really is, it's a tidal wave. It's not an ebb and flow. This is a tidal wave of gun control legislation. It's beginning in the blue states, it's spreading to the other states, and it is permeating the halls of Congress, including with Rhino support. You need to be ultra alert on this, folks. You need to join Gun Owners of America. It's very, I mean, it's well worthwhile, great newsletters, all sorts of information. You need to join NRA if you are not a member. It's like $35 a year or $25 a year. Buy your kids NRA memberships. This is, like everything else we are now involved in, this is the last great battle for the soul of this republic. And I guarantee you, if we're disarmed, well, first of all, I'm not going to say we're disarmed because nobody's going to disarm me. If they attempt to disarm the American population, not only is America lost, but the world is lost. The globalists will have won. The Second Amendment, voter fraud, and the border. I know that's not the same as what other people would say are the absolute priorities. Other people would say abortion. Other people would say child food or whatever. Other people would say education. But in my mind, we've lost the education battle for now. We need to start working on the next generation, the generation that's coming up. They're going to be 2-1 against us, 2-1 against the Constitution, 2-1 against capitalism, all the way through this. The only difference we can make in education is on the next generation, which we need to start doing. But you know what? No amount, nothing we do in all these other spheres is going to matter if the southern border is not closed and the demographics of this country and the voting block of this country by non-Americans is changed. It's not going to matter. Nothing's going to matter if we lose the rights to defend ourselves and defend ourselves particularly against a tyrannical government, just as the Constitution mandates and gives us the right to do. And nothing is going to matter unless there is equal justice under the law. And nothing is going to matter unless we know that the sanctity of our vote is sacrosanct. In other words, when I vote, my vote will not be canceled out or overshadowed by the vote that is illegally cast, illegally conjured, or cast by an illegal voter. Unless we get those three things done, the rest of this almost doesn't matter. So, some food for thought. This first show into the year of 2019, right? A year that is just 5 days old. I guess we can make it what we want to make it. It's time to advance, folks. Man the ramparts. Do not withdraw. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Have a great week. We'll talk at you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.